I've mentioned it before, but the Babylon Bee is a kind of a Christian satirical site, and it's just something that over time I have followed more and more. But they make some suggestions for winning people to Jesus, different ways that you can win people to Jesus. And by the way, this is satire, but the first one is this: you can hold up a picket sign that says, "Honk if you love Jesus, remain silent if you love the devil." That's one way to do it. Or you can put a bumper sticker on your car that says, "Don't let the car fool you, my treasure's in heaven." And then finally, three, totally own your opponents by arguing them into the faith by sheer brilliance of your intellect. Well, these are different means, different mechanisms, different ways that they suggest that we can be effective witnesses, but we know that that's not true. But Paul gives us a set of qualities that shows us exactly the kind of character that God calls us to have, that we might be an effective witness in the world. The first one we talked about last week, and that's boldness. That's boldness. And the one that we're looking at this week is sincerity or authenticity. But then there are others that we're going to look at as well: transparency, other-centeredness, industriousness, and encouraging. These are all encouragement. These are all different qualities that enable us to be effective witnesses in the world that we live. It's interesting that after Paul speaks about the need for boldness for Christians, he now turns to the need for sincerity or authenticity. We live in a world where this is in short supply, and this is not anything new. If you were to maybe spend a little time reading The Prince, The Prince was a book written by Machiavelli, and often you'll if you ever tune in to political talk shows or political television programs, they'll talk about Machiavellian strategy, Machiavellian tactics, and it's kind of cutthroat political thinking. And there was this man named Niccolò Machiavelli who wrote a book called The Prince in the 1530s, and he gave all kinds of what I would say diabolical advice to leaders of nations, leaders of states, and unfortunately people still follow his paradigms to this day. But one of the things that Machiavelli advised the prince was this. He said that there is nothing more important than appearing to be religious. He means appearing to be religious to the constituency that the prince oversaw. And at the same time, though, what Machiavelli argued is that under no circumstance can the prince actually live the Christian life, live out the Christian faith. He only needed to pretend. He needed to make his constituents think that he was a believer. And if he did that, they would trust him. But he couldn't rule as a prince. He couldn't do the down and dirty stuff that a ruler needs to do if he was a real Christian. And so under no circumstances could he be a real Christian, but he had to give the appearance of being a Christian for his subjects. This is again, nothing new, particularly in the area of political philosophy. There is a French political philosopher, his name was Jean-Jacques Rousseau, lived in the 18th century. And Rousseau argued that there's nothing worse for a nation than to have authentic Christians in that nation. And really, if you read the end of his book, The Social Contract, he talks about driving out anyone like that out of your country. People who live the faith authentically, these people won't look at the state as a god, they'll look at God in heaven as their God, and as a result of it, you can't control people like that who live authentically. And Rousseau has become kind of the inspiration for every tyrant who's lived after him. Marx, the father of communism, thought of Rousseau as an intellectual hero. Sadly, we have people in this country who think that the thinking of Rousseau is something that is good. But we can see in the whole realm of politics, can't we? See that all the time. We'll see politicians who have a kind of fabric of religiosity, but But we know when we dive down deep that there's nothing of the kind in their life. This is all Machiavellian. This is all just kind of revisiting Rousseau's way of thinking. Yeah, you can be a Christian, but only on the surface. But it goes deeper than that. It's the problem is that there have been so many Christians who have not been genuine. Paul was dealing with that. We remember, as we looked at it last time, that Paul went into the city of Thessalonica. He preached the gospel. People's lives were changed. And as a result of preaching the gospel and lives being changed, people got upset. There was a upheaval in the city. He had to steal away at night. And then he ended up in another city of Berea. He preaches the gospel. People go from Thessalonica to Berea, and they drive him out of that city. He ends up in Athens and finally in Corinth, where he writes this letter. But one of the things that Paul had to deal with was the fact that there were so many charlatans in his culture. Imagine that. Being a man like the Apostle Paul, a man of integrity, a man of godliness. But living in a day where there were so many charlatans, so many fakes. And so Paul is now justifying his own ministry, and he wants to show that he's authentic. But he also wants to impress upon us that God is calling us to be authentic in the way that we live our own Christian lives. One scholar writes this about the non-Christian missionaries that proliferated during Paul's day, who travel from city to city. This is from Bornkamm, a German theologian. He wrote this. He said, "The northern normal heathen missionaries were itinerant apostles and miracle workers of the most varied persuasions, heralds of heathen gods and dispensers of salvation, adroit and eloquent, ardent and evoking ardor, but also smart and conceited in extolling the mighty acts of their gods and fooling the masses." This is one of the great dangers, is that we as Christians can go through the course of our life just pretending to live the Christian life, but not really living it, pretending because there's certain benefits in it for us. And Paul wanted to make it clear that life is short, and that the way that we live it matters. And the reality is that this is no time to go through the motions of our Christian life. This is no time to go through the motions of our Christian life. And so he gives us the don'ts and the do's of living as an effective witness before Jesus. And so the don'ts. Number one, don't share fake news. Don't share fake news. Now, some of you probably are going back to all the stuff in the news cycle that we've been so accustomed to over the last several years, but that's not what I mean. I'm talking about let's not share a fake message. We need to know what the gospel is. We need to embrace the truth of the gospel. He says in verse 3 at the very beginning, "For our appeal does not spring from error." Our appeal does not spring from error. And this is something that's very important for us to maintain during this period of time. You know, people say that we live in this postmodern time, a time in which there is no truth. The more that our civilization, the more that our culture has become secularized, the more that God has pushed out of our culture, the more and more we are losing truth. And people are beginning to say that there are more than one way to answer a math problem. You can have more than one answer to 2 + 2 = 4. There can be 5. The more and more our culture pushes out God, the more secular we become, the more we lose a sense of what is true, what is truthful. I have a friend who went to law school, worked for many years going through law school, and I'm sure that most of us know how difficult that process is. And he went to law school, and he finally got to the end of law school, and then he decided not to practice law. So one day I asked him, I said, why aren't you practicing law? You've spent all this time earning this amazing degree. How come? And he said, well, I was taught in law school that my client has their truth, and that the other lawyer's client has their truth, and what my job is to work into the middle. He said, I can't live in a world like that, where there is no truth. Well, the reality is that this world that there is that truth is being ripped out of is not only hitting the world of law, but it's hitting our world. It's hitting us where we live, where people are beginning to claim that there is no truth, that there is no morality, that there is no God, and so we should eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's basically the thinking of the secular world. But Paul understood that the message that he had was a message of truth. It does not spring from error. The word error is used to describe someone who distorts the truth with malicious intent. So an example of this word, its usage, is found in Jude verse 11, where it describes something called Balaam's error. And if you're not familiar with Balaam, Balaam was an Old Testament prophet. Talked about him in the book of Numbers. There was a man named Balak who wanted Balaam to curse the children of Israel. But Balaam couldn't do it because Israel, the people of Israel, were God's chosen people. And so he couldn't do it. But then what Balaam did was he said, even though I can't curse the children of Israel, what I can do is I can help you get them to curse themselves. And so how did that happen? He said, well, have the women of your country entice the men of that country into sexual immorality, and that will draw them away from their God, and they will fall under God's curse because they're going to violate the covenant that they made with God in that. And so that's exactly how it worked. And so Balaam took a truth, but he distorted it for malicious intent. And what Paul says first and foremost is that the message that he shared was not one that had error. There is no malicious intent. It is a truth. It is a truth of the gospel. And it's very important that we as Christians all know what the gospel is. It's very important that we all know what the gospel is and that we can all explain it. One of my favorite youth leaders growing up in the church that I went to, his name was Gary. And Gary was one of the first people to get a pacemaker. He got a pacemaker in the early days. He was just a teenager when he got it. And by the time I had him as a youth leader, he was probably in his 30s. But he always lived with this awareness, this sense that he could die at any moment, because you could actually hear the pacemaker ticking in his chest. It was always a constant reminder to him. And he had to have it replaced several times, and he actually passed away in his 40s. But he used to always pull me aside and when I was a teenager, and he would say to me, Bruce, I'm dying. Tell me how to get to heaven. And I would say, call out to Jesus. I'm dying. What should I say to him? And I would stumble and I would mutter my way through, but he would do that every time. And so eventually, I was able to begin to articulate what the gospel message is, just simply by him taking me aside and doing that. Every Christian should know how to articulate the gospel message. It's the most important message in the world, that God made us to live in right relationship with him, but we rebelled against him and we fell into sin. And God is a just God and he must punish sin. And therefore, we were under his just sentence of death. But that God saw us in that state and sent his son to go to the cross to pay for our sin, so that if we turn from our sin and place our faith and trust in him, our sin will be transferred to him and that he will have paid for it on the cross for us, so that through faith in Jesus, we can have the righteousness of Christ given to us, and as a result of it, we can be reconciled to God. What a beautiful message of the gospel. What a gift. Every one of us needs to know how to articulate that message, because it is the truth that breathes life into every life. You think about that moment when you came to know Jesus, when he changed your heart, when he changed your life, when he washed away all your shame, all your guilt. You know, if you are a child of God, do you know that your sin is taken away? You don't have to live your life constantly fretting about the things you did in the past that you've already confessed to the Lord, that you've placed in his hand. It's all washed away. It's all gone. You've been given new life. This was the message that he had. This was a truthful message that he shared. And so the first thing is, don't share fake news. Share the true gospel, the pure gospel. There are all kinds of false gospels out there. There's what people call the prosperity gospel. There's a false gospel of the social gospel or social justice. These are all false gospels. We have one true gospel, And that is that God saw us in our desperate state, separated from himself, under his just wrath, and he sent his son to rescue us from it, so that all we have to do is turn from our sin and place our faith in Jesus, and all of our sin is washed away, and we will be forever with him. Praise be to this wonderful, mighty God. And why would we ever substitute one of these cheap imitations for that? What a blessing. Second thing, don't take advantage. Second thing he says to all of us is don't take advantage. Don't take advantage. He says, for our appeal does not spring from error or impurity. Error or impurity. Now he's speaking of motivation. The first thing he spoke to was our message. This is our motivation. And this word here for impurity could be translated filth. He says, for our appeal does not spring from error or filth. There are different words that could be used to describe this kind of filth that the word was used for. It could be ambition, pride, greed, popularity, immorality. There are all kinds of false reasons why people engage in Christian ministry and in the Christian life. Jesus said this in Mark 7:6, this people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. You know, all of this began in the garden. When Adam and Eve rebelled against God, they realized that they were naked. And the word naked there is a pun from the word crafty. It described the serpent in Genesis 3:1 as crafty, and so later on they realized they were naked. They were made in the image of God, but now somehow they had taken upon themselves and in some manner the image of the serpent when they rebelled against God. And so what they did was they had to make a covering for themselves. They wanted to hide behind a mask, a superficial mask of somehow covering their shame, but they couldn't do it. God could see right through it, couldn't he? Well, it's the same is true in our lives. Very often, people use the veneer of Christianity to take advantage of other people. Many of you might have read the news stories of a very prominent Christian leader, one who I admired. I will tell you, I admired him for his ability to articulate the Christian faith. We looked at him as a standard bearer of the Christian faith. And he passed away last fall. And when he did, or it could have been the summer, but when he passed away, there was much heartache and emotion. The church had lost a great spokesman, maybe one of the leading spokesmen in the last 40 years. And then all of a sudden, stories started trickling out about him, about all of his unbelievable, immoral activity. Stories began to trickle out about him as to how he used to use his Christian faith to manipulate people into inappropriate relationships with himself. And I tell you, that seemed as if it was one of the greatest betrayals that I think the Christian church has endured in my lifetime. But I want you to know it's nothing new. This has happened over and over and over and over again because there are so many people out there who are willing to use the gospel as a means to get something they want. And one of the beautiful things that we see about the Apostle Paul is that he was somebody who was unwilling to do that. And he says to us as Christians, we must be unwilling to do that. He didn't engage in the gospel work because he had some kind of impure motive. And by the way, this is really important. This is a lesson we can learn from this. Sometimes we have a tendency as Christians to put certain people on a pedestal. It could be somebody in our life, it could be our mother, it could be a friend that we have, it could be a Christian leader that we know, Christian leader that we don't know. We put them on this pedestal, and then when they fall off that pedestal, we're devastated. It's very important that we never put a person, no matter how effective they might be in the Lord's work, we never put a person in the place that only Christ belongs. Because you know what? Christ will never disappoint us. Men will. I'll disappoint you. Christ will never disappoint you. In fact, we read Philippians chapter 2, verses 6 through 8. Look at this picture of Jesus. this picture that we have of Jesus, who, though he was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be grasped, but emptied himself by taking the form of a servant, being born in the likeness of men. And being found in human form, he humbled himself by becoming obedient to the point of death, even death on a cross. And this is one of the great, glorious, beautiful things about God, is that God in himself is pure love. You know, when we think about God as Trinity, that's one of the most precious, beautiful doctrines that we could ever hold to, embrace, or believe. Because what the Trinity tells us is that God in his essence is love. God throughout all eternity has lived in perfect, inexpressible, even in our language, love. And then why did God create the world? Because the world, it tells us in Hebrews chapter 1, it says that Jesus is the heir of all things. You know what? If Jesus is the heir of all things, you know what that means? The world was created as a gift. The whole universe, the stars, everything that we see, everything was created as a gift from the Father to the Son, a gift of love. This is an expression of love. True love is self-giving. The Father gave all of this to the Son. And then where do we see this expression of self-giving love work its way out in our own lives? It's in the work of Jesus, who laid down his life for his creation, laid down his life for us. And that is our example. You see, we don't take advantage. We don't take advantage of others. And then the third thing we don't do is we don't use trickery. We don't use trickery. He says, we're going to continue on. In verse 3, for our appeal does not spring from error or impurity or any attempt to deceive. I remember when I was in school riding the bus, and there was a boy who liked a girl a lot. And the girl was this outstanding Christian girl. And the boy wasn't a Christian. And the boy knew he couldn't date the girl if he wasn't a Christian. So one day on the bus, he's riding along, and then all of a sudden he announces, "Hey y'all," we're down in North Carolina, "Hey y'all, I'm a Christian." And days go by, and she's not interested in him. So he became a Christian, hoping that he could date her, but she wasn't interested in him. And so the next week, guess what he did? "Hey, y'all, I'm not a Christian anymore." What was he doing? He was using trickery, wasn't he? He was trying to trick her into dating him because he liked her. And I can guarantee you, she had enough wisdom to see right through him. She could see right through him. Well, unfortunately, we do this all the time. We have a tendency to manipulate others or use Christianity as a means to get what we want. And sometimes people even use deception or trickery. And I remember when I was in school, we had this very famous preacher come to the school, and he had a week of talks. And during this week of talks, he said that he had something for us that we needed to commit ourselves to, but he wasn't going to tell us until the last day. So each day during the talks that he would give, he would have us do something else. He would have us go through this whole course of, he had all this methodology, these things that we did every day, but he never told us what it was that we were actually committing ourselves to. And so by the end, before he even announced what it was that we were going to be doing, and it was going to Russia, because the wall had come down, before he announced what it was that God was calling us to do, the whole student body began to rise. And not just the student body, people who were there, who had been there all week during this particular conference, everybody began to get up from their seats. And I would say there were thousands of people in line. And I was one of them. And there was a book in the front of the auditorium, and it had it, and you could put your name there. And we were putting our name, signing up to go somewhere and make a sacrifice, but we didn't even know where it was. And at the moment, everybody was just had this joyous emotion. There was this euphoria that accompanied it. And basically, I'm sure that the faculty of the school and the president was probably pulling his hair out, because basically, in one fell swoop, the whole school had agreed to go to Russia. And I remember after that whole week of conferences were over, I had a very wise, I was taking an American church history class, and I had a very wise professor. His name is Dr. Greg Quigel. And we all were talking to him about how we're all going to Russia. And then he said, you know what, I think we're going to read another book. And so this book was written by an evangelist in the 1800s. I won't say his name. But the book was written by an evangelist in the 1800s, and it had methods for creating revivals, making revivals happen, like you could just create them. And all of a sudden, we are reading through the book, and then we see that this guy followed all of the steps that were laid out in this book. And my professor didn't have to tell me, because I already knew it. And then I realized that this whole thing was just a psychological trick. It was a psychological trick. It was a certain set of things that if you get people to do, you can make them respond in the way that you want them to respond. Then that just turned my stomach. Turned my stomach to know that I'd been manipulated. I was 19 or 20 years old and wanted to serve the Lord, and that somebody would take that and use that as a means to accomplish some bigger goal that they had, whether or not that might have been a laudable goal or not. It was trickery. I want you to know that we are firmly opposed to any form of trickery that might manipulate someone into making a decision that they don't really mean. Think about it for a second. Think about it for a second. Imagine being part of a congregation that uses all kinds of psychological techniques and trickery to manipulate people into saying they've made a profession for Christ when they really haven't. To say that they're a believer when they really don't know the Lord. They haven't experienced that the new life that Christ gives. They haven't been born again, but they think they have, and the church is full of people like that. Don't you think that that church will be a stench to the community around us? Don't you think that church will be full of hypocrisy? Don't you, if we build a church with people who think they're saved when they're not really saved, what damage could that do? Not only to their lives, to their family lives, but to the gospel in our community. And so one of the things that we see about the Apostle Paul is that he refused to use any means of deception or trickery. He just proclaimed the simple gospel of God, and he awaited for God to do his work. And you know the beautiful part of it was? God did his work. He didn't have to trick anybody, didn't have to manipulate anybody in Thessalonica. It's just God's work. God did it, and there's nothing more beautiful than to see that. One of the most wonderful things that there is as a pastor is to hear the story about people who are just somewhere by themselves, and God's Spirit begins to work in their heart and draws them to himself, and they open up their Bible and they come to Christ, and there's this authentic turning from sin and authentic turning to God. And there's nothing more beautiful than that, because you just see it lived out in their life. There's just no other way of explaining it other than to say that God did it. So beautiful. We don't use trickery, we don't take advantage, and we don't share fake news. Second thing we notice is the dues of an effective witness. Look at verse 4. But just as we have been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel, so we speak not to please men, but to please God who tests our hearts. The first thing that we need to remember is do remember that we have been given a sacred trust. We've been given a sacred trust. He says that they've been approved. The word here is in the perfect tense, which refers to something that happened in the past that has ongoing significance in the present. They've been approved by God to be entrusted with the gospel. Paul talks about this in other ways. In Ephesians chapter 6, verse 20, he says, "For which I am an ambassador in chains, that I may declare it boldly as I ought to speak." Paul saw himself as God's ambassador. He was God's representative. Even if he was in jail, he was God's representative in that place. He is approved. This word carries with it the sense of being tested. And then later on, not just he was tested in the past and he was approved, but God continues to test him. If we look at the end of that verse, he says, not to please man, but to please God who tests our hearts. That's present tense. That means that God continually tests him. So on the one hand, he's been tested and approved, but on the other hand, he's saying God continually tests him. And that's how it is for all of us. as we serve the Lord. Jeremiah 17, 9 and 10, why does God test us? Well, this is why. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? I, the Lord, search the heart and test the mind to give every man according to his ways, according to the fruit of his deeds. You see, God tests the heart. And you know, from every generation, there's a desire among Christians that God would search us and test us. Psalm 139, verses 23 and 24 says this, "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts, and see if there be any grievous way in me, and lead me in the way of understanding." What a beautiful, beautiful truth. Lead me in the way of everlasting. See, this is what the psalmist wanted God to test him. And remember Ray Pritchard, my pastor growing up, he used to say, people don't live up to what you expect, they live up to what you inspect. And that's true. The Lord inspected Paul. Paul knew that. And so Paul understood that he had been given a sacred trust, the trust of the gospel. And so therefore he understood that God continually tested him in his life. He wanted to be faithful to the task. Don't you want to be faithful to the task that God has given you? The second thing that we need to remember what this is all for, what it's all for. Greg Beale, he says this. He says, sin occurs when we want to please people so badly that we sometimes do that we do so in the wrong way. Let me read that again. Sin occurs when we want to please people so badly that we sometimes do so in the wrong and worldly ways. Well, Paul had no interest in pleasing men. He says, so we speak, present tense, it means continually speak, not to please men, but to please God who tests our hearts. You know, the reality is that living for men's applause isn't all it's cracked up to be anyway. The second that we're living to please somebody, and there are all kinds of people that we tend to want to please. Maybe it's our father. How many men do you know of who are constantly living trying to gain the approval of their father, even after their father's passed away, and they could never get it, and they wanted it so badly and couldn't get it. Or maybe we're living for the approval of our mother, maybe living for the approval of a friend, maybe it's of somebody we respect, but we're constantly trying to get their approval, and it's something that we can never have. Well, you know, when we live for the applause of men, on the one hand, yes, we might get it in some occasions. We might hear people clapping for us or giving us a pat on the back, but it won't be very long before somebody else will come along who want to put us right in our place. You ever have that happen to you? You felt like you did something significant, and as soon as you began to feel good about that and people began to come alongside of you and to give you the acclamation that you wanted, all of a sudden they just stuck a pin in the balloon of your life and deflated you. You ever experienced that? It's a double-edged sword trying to live to please men. Yes, we can get it to a certain degree, but it won't be long before we get put in our place. And Paul wanted to get off of that treadmill, pleasing men. When we live to please men, we only set ourselves up for failure. And so he says, so we speak not to please man, but to please God who tests our hearts. It's only his opinion that matters. Well, just want to mention three applications. Number one, personally commit to live life intentionally for Christ. Personally commit to live life intentionally for Christ. There is nothing more disappointing than to see someone just going through the motions, is there? Just wasting potential, wasting their life. Remember, we used to have this guy, I won't say his name, not even his first name, but my first job was working in printing. And so we had this guy who worked in shipping and receiving who was amazing. He was amazing at something. He was amazing at doing nothing. Amazing. You ever have somebody like that? This guy, all day long, and this is one of the bosses clued me into this. They couldn't do anything about him being there, but one of the bosses clued me into it. Said, just watch so-and-so. So I remember watching him, and he would take a cup, and he'd move it here, and he'd take a pencil, and he would move it there. And a little while later, he'd take his cup and he'd move it to another spot and his pencil to a different spot. And all day long, All day long, that's all he did, was he moved around. He was in perpetual motion. But he never accomplished a single thing unless he had to. And you think about all that potential. You think about what he could have done. You think about all the value he could have added to the company that he went to. You think about all the sense of fulfillment that he could have had if he would have just been productive and used his time wisely. But he wasted it. How often do we do that in the Christian life? We do the perfunctory things in the Christian life. We say the perfunctory things in the Christian life, but we're not really living it. May we be a people who live it, who experience it, who know the joy, who don't waste it. There's a man named A.J. Gordon. I don't know how many of you are familiar with him. A.J. Gordon was a Baptist pastor here in Boston. Gordon College was named after him. Gordon Conwell Seminary bears his name, at least the first half. We've got a lot of Gordon grads in the church. But A.J. Gordon one time was preaching, and as he was preaching, there was somebody who came in who just grabbed his attention. And so he couldn't get his eyes off of this person, and he wanted to talk to the person after the service. And so the service ended. He made a beeline where that person was, but by the time he got there, the person was gone. So he grabbed an usher who was in the area, and he said, who was that? And the guy said, you don't know who it was? He said, that was Jesus. Jesus was here. And A.J. Gordon then woke up from his dream. And then that changed everything in his life. That dream changed everything in his life. He came to the realization that Jesus is present every time he preached a message, every time he entered into worship. Jesus was there. It changed the way he preached, changed the way he talked. He was preaching knowing that he was in the presence of Jesus Christ. Think about how that changes the way we worship. Think about the way that that changes the way that we live. If we just are cognizant, if we are aware that right now, as we are worshiping, right now, Jesus is here with us. He sees our hearts. He sees what goes through our minds. He sees everything that we do. He knows it all. He knows what we're thinking. Don't we want to live our lives in a way that lifts him up and proclaims him and honors him and glorifies him? The Lord's here. He's here among us. So if we know the Lord is among us, why would we go through the motions? And not just our worship, but our whole life. Why go through the motions of our Christian life when Christ lives and he is with us in all that we do? Second point of application is this. Don't get hung up on past failures. Each day presents a new opportunity to impact others for Christ. That's one of the things that we struggle with, right? We know that we have failed in the past, and we say, well, what am I going to do now? Well, what God wants us to do is go forward with whatever he's given us to glorify him. We can't do anything about yesterday, can we? But we can glorify God with our life today and every day afterward. It's been said that the type of disciples that we make are often reflective of the kind of disciples we are. What kind of disciple? What kind of disciple do you want to see your kids be? What kind of disciple do you want to see your friends become? Well, we need to become that kind of disciple that they will walk in a manner worthy of Jesus when they see the way that we live, if we live in a way that's worthy of Jesus. And then number three, we must constantly remind ourselves that we have an audience of one. We must constantly remind ourselves that we have an audience of one. It's hard. It's hard to do that because so few people appreciate the idea that we would just want to live to please Christ and Christ alone, right? People want us to live to please them. But on the other hand, it's really, really liberating. There was in the early 1990s, President George Bush had a chief of staff. His name was John Sununu. And he was once asked by a reporter, if his job was difficult, and he said, no. And the reporter thought that he misunderstood what he was saying, and so the reporter went to him again and said, as chief of staff to the president of the United States, said to him, do you have a difficult job? And he said, no. He said, well, why would you say something like that? And he said, my job is easy because I only have one constituent. I have only one person to please. On the one hand, yeah, if we go through life and we're trying to please all kinds of people, and that might make them happy, but you know what we become? We become like a chicken running around with its head cut off, trying to please everyone. But when we go through life only desiring to please Christ, you know what? At that moment, not only will we please him in the way that we live, but we're going to become the best parent we could ever be. We're going to become the best boss we could ever be. We will become the best employee that we could ever be. We will become the best friend that we will ever be. We will become the best student that we could possibly be, because we are living to please Christ. And because we're living to please Christ and we love Christ, we are going to want to be a blessing to whoever it is in our lives. You see, if we try to live to please all of these people, we will fail. And the only sure route to being a blessing to the other people in our lives is by seeking an audience of one, of serving Christ, to faithfully be his child, to faithfully walk in the steps that he calls us to live in. I just have a question for you today. Maybe there's some here today who's never experienced this gospel. Maybe you've never come to Jesus. Maybe you've never... You don't have a personal relationship with Jesus. Maybe you were manipulated into making a decision about Christ that you didn't really mean. And you know right now that you don't have a relationship with the Lord, that you don't know what it is to be born again, that you don't know what it is to be transformed from the inside out. You know that this day could be the day of your salvation, where you come to him and you cry out to him and say, Lord, save me. I'm a sinful person. And I'm hopeless without you. And I know that I am under your wrath as a result of what I've done, your condemnation, but you sent your son to take upon himself my condemnation so that through him I might have your righteousness. And you know at that moment your sins will be washed away, your life will be made new. Have you come to a place where you have experienced the life-changing power of Jesus Christ, where you've been born from above, born again? If you don't know this Savior, I'd like you to pray with me that you might experience in him the only life worth living. Let's pray.